Way One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, John Russell has a story on how electric vehicles made by General Motors will be able to use much of Tesla's charging network beginning early next year. Brian Lynn has this week's science report on new research about solar wind, and we present the next part in our American history series. But first,
electric vehicles made by General Motors, or GM, will be able to use much of Tesla's charging network in the United States beginning early next year. GM will also begin using Tesla's connector, the device that connects an electric vehicle to a charging station. GM joins Ford in changing its electric vehicles, or EVs, to work with about 12,000 of Tesla's 17,000 chargers. The two big American automakers are pushing to make Tesla's connector the most widely used in the industry. GM CEO Mary Barra and Tesla's CEO Elon Musk made the announcement recently during a Twitter Spaces discussion. In May, Ford CEO Jim Farley joined Musk to announce that Ford's electric vehicles would be able to use much of Tesla's charging network. Tesla's system of electric charging stations is the largest in the nation. Farley said Ford would switch to Tesla's connector instead of going with the connector used by the rest of the industry. At first, GM and Ford EV owners will need an additional device, an adapter, to be able to use the Tesla stations, which have their own connector. But GM and Ford will switch to Tesla's North American Charging Standard connector starting with new EVs produced in 2025. Tesla has about 17,000 supercharger stations in the U.S. The U.S. Department of Energy says there are about 54,000 public charging stations in the U.S., but many of the public stations charge much more slowly than the Tesla stations. Like Ford, we see this as an opportunity to expand access to charging, Barra said, adding that GM hopes the rest of the industry will move to the Tesla charging connector. Tesla's connector is different from the CCS connector used on most other electric vehicles. Musk said that GM and Tesla vehicles would have an even playing field at the charging stations. We will provide support equally to both, he said. The most important thing is we advance the electric vehicle revolution. Financial details of the agreement between the two companies were not released, but GM spokesman Daryl Harrison said GM is not paying Tesla. There are other opportunities both companies can take advantage of as a result of the agreement, Harrison said. Details of the deal are still being worked out. GM EV owners may have to pay a monthly payment to use Tesla's charging network, or they could pay for each use. Current GM owners probably will need to buy the adapter, Harrison said. Tesla's charging network is a huge competitive advantage for the company based in Austin, Texas. Tesla sells more EVs than any other company in the U.S. Chargers often are near major roads, making it easier to go on long trips, where most fast charging plugs are needed. But permitting EVs from GM and Ford to use Tesla stations will make it easier for their owners to charge while traveling. The deal also could affect some Tesla owners who already are competing for space at some of the busier supercharger stations that are mostly in California. Barra said joining Tesla's network would almost double the number of chargers available to GM electric vehicle owners. Mike Austin, an electric vehicles expert for Guidehouse Insights, said GM joining the Tesla network is a step toward making Tesla's connector the most widely used in the industry. It seems like there's a lot of momentum going the way of the North American charging standard, for sure, he said. I'm John Russell.
Scientists say a spacecraft flying very close to the sun has uncovered new details about the nature of solar wind. Solar wind is created by a continuous flow of charged particles, known as plasma, that are released into space from the sun's outermost atmosphere. That atmosphere is known as the corona. Researchers recently announced they had learned new information about solar wind from data collected by the Parker Solar Probe. The American space agency NASA operates the spacecraft. NASA launched the Parker Solar Probe in 2018 with a main goal of studying solar wind. Scientists say studying solar wind and the corona close up is important to learn how solar activity influences Earth. Unlike Earth, the sun does not have a solid surface. Instead, it is a superheated ball of material held together by gravity and magnetic forces. Some solar material escapes from the sun and is released into space as solar wind. In 2021, researchers announced that the Parker Solar Probe had entered the sun's corona for the very first time. NASA described the successful operation as touching the sun. Scientists said Parker was about 13 million kilometers from the center of the sun when it crossed into the sun's outer atmosphere. Data collected by the spacecraft showed that solar wind can reach speeds up to 1.6 million kilometers per hour. Solar wind forms a large magnetic barrier known as the heliosphere. It protects Earth and other planets from the continuous flow of high-energy particles from the sun's corona. The researchers recently reported their findings in a study published in Nature. The team said the collected data suggests these particles get blasted from the sun in a similar way that water shoots out from a showerhead. The particles are released through holes in the sun's corona. The researchers said the data suggests these openings are the source of solar wind. Past research had found that the sun's magnetic field was somehow driving solar wind. This study is the first to identify its source. James Drake is a professor of physics at the University of Maryland and a lead writer of the study. He said in a statement, "Winds carry lots of information from the sun to Earth, so understanding the source behind the sun's wind is important for practical reasons on Earth." Drake said that understanding how the sun releases energy can help scientists learn how to prepare for solar storms that can affect Earth. For example, intense solar activity can cause solar flares, explosions of electromagnetic radiation from the sun. This can interfere with different radio communication signals on Earth. The researchers said the data showed that the holes in the sun's corona are usually in areas around the poles during the sun's quiet periods. This prevents the speeding particles from affecting Earth. However, the team noted that the sun becomes active every 11 years as its magnetic field changes and the poles exchange positions. This results in bursts of solar wind aimed directly at Earth, the researchers said in a statement. The researchers used data from the Parker Solar Probe to examine plasma flowing out of the corona. Data for the latest research was collected at a distance of about 9 million kilometers from the sun, the team said. When you get very close to the sun, you start seeing stuff that you just can't see from Earth, Drake said. He added that the findings were only possible because the Parker Solar Probe was able to pass so close to the surface of the sun. "We're about as close as we're going to get," Drake said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about this week's science report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Sure, Dan. Glad to be here.
Your report described findings made by a NASA spacecraft studying the sun. And researchers reported new information about solar wind. Why are their findings important?
Yes, so the research team suggested the findings are important because they think they identified the actual source of solar wind. The report notes that while past studies explained how solar wind works, they were not able to find the exact source of it. And the scientists say that knowing the source of solar wind can help them better prepare for storms that can affect us here on Earth.
And the findings were based on data collected by NASA's Parker Solar Probe. What can you tell us about the spacecraft?
So Parker was launched in 2018 with really just a single mission to study solar wind. And the researchers made clear that their latest findings could not have been made without data from this spacecraft. Parker is operating really close to the sun's surface, closer than any spacecraft has come before. And in fact, as part of its mission, the spacecraft entered the sun's outermost atmosphere, called the corona, for the first time in 2021.
Interesting. Thanks again, Brian, for joining me to explain more about this week's science report.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dan.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988. George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START 1. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START 1 became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another strategic arms reduction treaty, START 2, in January 1993.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The council set a deadline of January 15, 1991. But Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart. His second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey, and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia. The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, five times that number, 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked, aid workers assaulted, ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. But by the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.